So we've come to the fourth Satipatthana, Dhammas. And this word Dhamma has a wide range of meaning depending on the context. It can mean truth, law, teachings of the Buddha, as well as referring to specific elements of mind and body. Each of the mental and physical elements is called a Dhamma. And Bhante refers to the fourth Satipatthana. He talks here about mental objects. So we become aware of something, for example, a thought as a thought. You're aware of a thought as a thought. You know you're aware of that thought. And you turn your subjective experience into a mental object. You see it more as a phenomena. It's not my thought. It's not this entanglement of things mixed up with my attitudes and my liking and my all of this stuff. The thought is seen then as an object. And it's a mental object. It's happening in the mind. Similarly with a hindrance, the hindrance sense desire, you recognize it from the perspective of the fourth Satipatthana, knowing this as an object, a Dhamma object. It's a particular arising in the mind, and it's not about me. And that's how we're relating to these phenomena. And Bhante calls them mental objects. Anālayo calls them categories of phenomena. So this means highlighting how different dhammas or elements of experience function. This is a category of phenomena, and we've got categories in the fourth Satipatthana. We've got the Four Noble Truths, we've got the skandhas, the sense spheres, the hindrances, awakening factors. So these are categories of experience, looked at with a dharmic perspective. I'll be unpacking this, so don't worry too much about it just at the moment. Dhammas are not a different sort of experience. Body and mind were included in the third Satipatthana. That is the all. There's nothing else outside of the all of these bodily and mental experiences. This is a shift in perspective. Fourth Satipatthana is about a shift in perspective. It's not about bringing in some kind of experience that I haven't discovered yet, I haven't heard about. Richard Gombrich refers to it as learning to see the world through Buddhist spectacles. And that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? That's easy enough. So viewing our experience through the lens of the Buddha's teaching. And we study, we find out what the Buddha has taught, and now this is about the application here. Maitreya Bandhu talks about the fourth Satipatthana as bringing the teachings to mind. This is what's going on. I'm really frustrated, I'm really angry, my back's hurting. Bring the teachings to mind. So shift your perspective. So we're applying the teachings here. And another writer, Michael Carithus, who wrote about the forest monks in Sri Lanka, talking about the fourth Satipatthana, this is a quote from him, the propositions of doctrine are transmuted into immediate perception here and now. So the propositions of doctrine, Buddha's teachings, transmuted into immediate perception here and now. This is about bringing the teachings to life. Yeah? It's not the philosophical, intellectual arena. Yeah? So here with this fourth Satipatthana, well, in fact, with the whole of Satipatthana practice, instead of philosophical analysis and discussion, which has its place, yeah, but when we're practicing, yeah, the Buddha is showing us how to investigate these truths and dharmas for ourselves, yeah, in our experience. So applying these teachings to life, to your life, wherever you are, whenever. Yeah. So mindfulness is always applicable with this perspective. And the perspective we're taking is the perspective of right view. Yeah. We're always coming from a view. And the strength or the value of right view is to be able to notice the other views that we're holding. So right view has a kind of flavor of a neutral perspective. There's no me invested in that. Mm-hmm. And right view enables us to see where we cause ourselves suffering by making things more permanent and more substantial than they are. You know, it's the topsy-turvies, viparyanas. We see that which is impermanent as permanent, and that causes us suffering. Mm-hmm. And so on. Mm-hmm. And also by taking these things personally. Yeah. We cause ourselves suffering by taking them personally. It's all about me. Yeah. Remember one of the instructions with regard to thinking? Just pay attention how much of your thinking is about me, mine, I. Yeah. So bringing in right view helps identification to drop away more. Yeah. And it allows views we hold to be seen in a helpful way. So not reinforcing them, not indulging, not suppressing. Mm-hmm. It's natural that we have views. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these views are helpful, but not seen with a dharmic perspective, they are limited and cause suffering, because they're not in accord with how things are. Mm. And right view allows experience to be seen for what it is. It's changing, it's impermanent, it is not self. Yeah. And clinging to it causes suffering. So in the practice, we become aware, and we have become aware, we've been doing this over the last week, of view forming, of the view forming process that begins with reactions to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experiences. Yeah. This shouldn't be happening. This isn't right. This isn't fair. Because yeah. It's unpleasant. Don't want it. Yeah. But this is where we get in there. This is where the view, out of which the views arise, the reactions to the Vedana. Yeah. I'm the sort of person who doesn't do this, who doesn't have that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we can be asking ourselves, a bit like I was encouraging you to do yesterday with some of my examples, yeah. Go deeper, yeah. Look at the next layer. Ask, what's the view behind this? What's the point of view in my mind, yeah, that's leading me to see it like this, to get into this situation? You know, my example from a few days ago about the date and wearing my glasses as a teenager, yeah, the underlying view there was that girls who wear glasses are not attractive. Girls who wear glasses don't get boyfriends. Yeah, and that's the view. Yeah. Yeah, it's painful, painful, yeah. So becoming aware, recognizing it's all about recognition, yeah, arising out of awareness, enables us to let be more. I'm not saying letting go, yeah, just let go. It's not that easy. But we can let things be more. So if you remember, we had these three aspects to Satipatthana practice. Aware of what's actually happening. What is the direct felt experience? Aware of its changing nature. And how am I relating to it? So it's not about changing what's there. What's there is there. It's arisen. Independence on causes and conditions, it's there. Yeah? It's relating to it from a dharmic perspective. That is what's going to lead us to more happiness, to more freedom, to peace. And we've already we've been working with right view all along, I think. Yeah. When we looked at the refrain, if you remember, just let it like that. Looking at the refrain, then. Yeah. So this is like, how are we looking at the direct experience? We looked at internally, externally, both internally and externally. We looked at arising and passing, both arising and passing. We looked at the bare knowing, continuity of mindfulness, and then independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Now these are pointing to right view. Yeah? They imply right view. So internally, externally, yeah, this is in relation to anatta. So it's the view of seeing phenomena through the lenses of the lakshanas that I'm referring to here. So internally, externally, not just about me. This interconnectedness. It's phenomena arising, breathing is happening, thinking is happening, yeah? And it's not just in me, it is in others too. Arising and passing, it's pretty clear, isn't it? Yeah, anicca, impermanence. And then the third, bare knowing, continuity of mindfulness, yeah? So we're just for the sake of being mindful here, be mindful, be aware of what's there just as it is. Yeah? And you remember the day we had the Bahya reading, in the scene, just the scene. So again, this is referring to anatta. It's taking out the me, mine, owning it, being it. Yeah, doing it, having it. It's just what's there. In the seen, just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. Anatta means not self. Not self. Personally, I find that much more helpful than saying no self. Then we get into all this, I haven't got a self. And, well, that's a whole other discussion. Yeah, but not self just makes it clear. There is not a self. Kind of in the driving seat there, to whom this is happening, who is guiding it, who is owning it. Yeah, it's not self. And independence, not clinging to anything in the world. Yeah. So this is talking about attachment, clinging, yeah, which are the causes of suffering. So this is dukkha.
nature.
Yeah, that's good that you're picking that up. In a way, these three lakshanas, they're like gates into seeing reality. Yeah, and you can go in through any one of them and you discover the others. Yeah, so you really, really engage with anicca, with impermanence, and you will see anatta. Yeah, and you will see that clinging to a self is painful. Yeah, so you know, we've got these three ways in, but they all open out into one another. And you might remember me saying, you know, not clinging is the bottom line, yeah? Because clinging causes suffering. Yeah? And what did the Buddha teach us? I teach one thing and one thing only, cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering and the path that leads to that. Yeah. So, if you, well, let's just read it. Let's take the time to go back to the sutta. In the fourth Satipatthana, just look at the headings. If you've got it to hand, you don't need it. We're not going to read through it or anything. But when the sutta moves on to Dhammas, the fourth Satipatthanas, begins with the aggregates, yeah? So with the skandhas. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to go into all of this. You know, if this were a study retreat, we would be doing that. But it's about applying it in meditation. But I just want to mention these here, draw your attention. So there are these different categories, phenomena grouped together. Skandhas really is pointing to, there is no self to be found in the skandhas. Yeah? So it's not self again, neither in the body, senses, vedana, perception, intention, volitions. And we've been engaging with all of these just through practice, but we haven't been kind of discussing and analysing in that way. Mm-hmm. So implicitly, yeah, this is implicit here too, the skandhas. The Four Noble Truths are implicit in the fourth refrain here about dukkha. Mm-hmm. And the sense spheres, which is another one of the, comes after the aggregates. We have aggregates, sense spheres, awakening factors, hindrances, yeah, and the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths are implicit here. We've been talking about suffering, what leads to suffering, and what alleviates suffering. Yeah. So in all of this, now let me just pause for a moment with the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. The Four Noble Truths are also, they're implicit here because mindfulness, the way we've been practicing it, is samasati. It's part of the Eightfold Path. This is not just being aware. Yeah. It's part of the Eightfold Path. So this is the Fourth Noble Truth coming in here. Yeah, that's what we've actually been doing here. Mm-hmm. And this is the mindfulness which supports wisdom. Mm-hmm. There's this image of how sati helps wisdom to flourish. Yeah. Sati is compared to the neck of the elephant, holds the head, yeah? And the head is prana. The head of the elephant is prana, the neck of the elephant is sati. So it is mindfulness as I said right at the beginning, in the service of wisdom of that's going to lead to liberation. And Analia has got a nice pithy, another pithy description for the fourth Satipatthana, and that is pointing the mind to break through into liberation. Yeah. So you're looking in a way, you're investigating, recognizing, being in aware in a way that's going to point the mind towards breaking through into liberation. Yeah. We've been engaging with conditionality in all different kinds of ways in our practice. And the two parts of the fourth Satipatthana that I'm going to focus on a little bit more, which have direct relevance to our working with our mind, are the hindrances and the awakening factors. Yeah. And this is looking at conditionality, focusing on these two areas where conditionality shows up, is at work. Mm-hmm. And the hindrances, the awakening factors, have direct effects on the mind. And basically, what it's all about is hindrances out, awakening factors in. Yeah. If it were that easy. And I'm going to try and relate this now as closely as I can to our meditation practice. So the hindrances are five areas, topics that prevent us from meditating. By meditating, please don't get stuck in this idea of formal meditation. Yeah, you could just as well say it's training the mind, it's transforming the mind. Yeah. Some people have real difficulties sitting meditating. Yeah. And as long as you're looking for ways to work with your mind, that's what matters. That you're training your mind, that's what matters. Yeah. And that might be outside of like a formal structure of a practice. Mm-hmm. So the hindrances point to what's most prominent in preventing the mind from becoming calm, content, clear, from energy and joy arising. And it's about starving the hindrances, so not feeding them, not fueling them. We're not becoming averse to them. They are not our enemies, but we're not going to feed them because we know their nature. They're not helpful if we're moving towards freeing the mind. And we're feeding and nourishing the awakening factors. Yeah. So feeding. No. We are starving the hindrances, and we are feeding and nourishing the awakening factors. It's a juxtaposition. Yeah. So not getting caught up in the hindrances, turning more to the awakening factors, which I'll talk about in a little while. First, I want to look more at the hindrances. And in order to open up to the awakening factors, we have to deal with the hindrances. Yeah. And the whole of this practice here, culminating in a way in the fourth Satipatthana, what is the view, what is the perspective? Yeah. This whole practice is nourishment for the awakening factors. Satipatthana is nourishment for the awakening factors. And the awakening factors are a way of getting more of a sense. You know, we want to awaken, don't we? That's why we're here. We've dedicated our lives to the three jewels. This is our path. So what's going to help me to get more of a sense of that, a feel for it, right here and now? And I think the awakening factors are really, really helpful to engage with those more. Okay, so with regard to the hindrances, I know you've studied the hindrances, you learned it in your first meditation courses. It's not about that. It's more about getting a felt sense for their presence. Yeah? What is the nature of these hindrances? Later on, I'm going to lead a meditation around this. But first of all, I wanted to remind you of similes that the Buddha uses to communicate the presence of the hindrances. Yeah? And you'll know these. And it's more about, hear it. What does that feel like? A mind that is like this. Mm-hmm. So, the simile that the Buddha uses for a mind that is distracted by sense desire, he uses these water similes. This is what I'm referring to. Yeah? Water mixed with turmeric, blue dye, or crimson dye. Yeah? So, and if a man with, or a woman, if a woman with good sight were to examine her own facial reflection in it, she would not know and not see it as it really is. Why not? Because there's so many colours in there, yeah? So seeing all the colours, getting distracted by all this, oh, that's interesting, that's fascinating. Yeah? So these colours, the dyes in there, in the water, are taking us away from the clear seeing. The water's not clear. So this is what the mind is like when sense desire is present. You get fascinated by the sense desire, or you get overwhelmed by it, yeah? Or you get blinded by it. Then, the simile for ill will, yeah, aversion. Suppose there were a bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling. If a woman with good eyesight were to examine her own facial reflection in it, she would not know and not see it as it really is. So this ill will, water boiling, bubbling, yeah, energy there, heat there, yeah, up to being consuming. Just getting a sense of that. And this these images, I find they're quite powerful because they take over, don't they? We get kind of sucked in. Then sloth and torpor, water covered with algae and water plants. Yeah. So there's a heaviness here. You can't, it's so full and dense and, yeah, there's no seeing at all, drawing down heavy by the algae and the water plants. Restlessness and worry or anxiety. A bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. So the wind whipping across the surface of the water. Yeah. And you can't see a thing then if you look into that kind of water. Yeah. It's too restless. Yeah. Too much agitation. So just imagine looking into water where these things are present. And that can communicate a felt sense, and it gives you an angle on, ah, is this what's going on in my mind? More interesting. I'm interested in it at the moment. I find it fascinating at the moment. The Buddha also has similes for the absence of the hindrances. And I thought I'd just remind us of these. So the first one is...
Sorry, is there one felt?
Oh, I forgot to turn over. Yes, there is. Of course there is. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Water that is cloudy, turbid and muddy, placed in the dark. Yeah. So you can't see. If doubt is in the mind, you can't see your way. You don't know which way to go. I can't see it. I don't know. Hard to see. Yeah, thanks, Maria. So we've got the water mixed with colour, water over a fire, water covered with algae, water stirred by the wind, and water in the dark. Yes. This is the Sangharava Sutta, AN3230. I can write these up because I'm going to refer to another set now, and it's really helpful to just read them as the Buddha spoke about them. Yeah. And this next set is from another sutta where the Buddha talks about, he uses similes illustrating the absence of the hindrances. So what does it feel like? What's the felt sense of not having these hindrances present? Mm-hmm. So the first one is, suppose a woman were to take a loan and undertake business, and her business were to succeed so that she would repay all the money of the old loan, and there would remain enough extra to maintain her partner, then on considering this, she would be glad and full of joy. So this is the state. You're free of debt. You've been in debt. Yeah? Schulden. You've been in debt. And you are free of this debt. Yeah. This is a relief. No, that was German. Schulden, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you're free of debt, yeah, you are free to be generous as well. You can't be generous if you are caught up with craving and wanting all the time, because you are never satisfied. You're free of a debt. You have surplus, in a way. Yeah, you feel you have, and you can be generous then.
Does that relate to defensive
violence? Yeah. Mm.
That kind of concept's used by Bhante, where he says that's spiritual poverty.
The next one is someone who's been very, very ill, has suffered a lot, couldn't eat her food, and then later recovers from this illness. Regained strength, recovered from the illness, and then on recovery, full of gladness and full of joy. Actually, I'll read them out. You might like for yourself to find which hindrance is this referring to. Yeah, think about it. So someone has recovered from a disease. The next one is, suppose a person were in prison. Yeah. And then later released from prison. Safe, secure, returning back to his or her life. fourth one is a person released from, set free from slavery. Someone who'd been a slave, robbed of independence, and is now self-dependent, independent of others, a free person, able to go where she wants. And the last one, there's a simile of trying to cross a desert. There are no paths in a desert, and there are no signposts in the desert, and it all looks the same. But you successfully and safely cross the desert. So you've found your way after being lost. Okay, so we already had that the debt is that you are free to be generous then. You have no debts. So this to be without craving, to not feel always coming from a lack. What do you think ill will the The disease, disease, lack of ease, perturbed, ill will can feel like a disease. It consumes us, poisons us. When the body is ill, it's out of balance. It's a kind of poison. This is what it's pointing to. Without strength, without energy. If you're consumed by aversion and ill will, you've got no strength, because that takes it all. Prison, being set free from prison. Any ideas? Yeah, you can't, that's right, you're in a dark cell, you're in a cell in prison. I mean, you have to, don't think about prisons nowadays, this is the Buddha talking. You know, it would be a dark, small, confined cell. You can't move, so sloth and torpor. There's enforced passivity. Kind of closing down, stuck in the cell. And then released from being a slave, released from slavery. Why do you think that?
If you're anxious and very shut down, closed down, you're not free.
Well, you're not free, And if you're a slave, you are pushed and pulled around by others. You're not free to move. So this is restlessness, anxiety, pushes us around, pulls us around, always having to be somewhere else, do something else, at someone else's beck and call. You are not deciding. You have a boss. You have an owner. You're not free. And it's like this, what's it like to be a slave to anxiety? Sort of stuck in it, unfree. At the mercy, you're at the mercy of something that is tossing you about, like your boss, your master, sending you around, there. Sorry? And then the last one then, someone who has found their way, they've accomplished a journey, found the path. Yeah. It's doubt. Yeah. You can see where you need to go, see what needs to be done. Yeah. And then you arrive safely to be free of doubt. You know what you're doing, you know where you are. That is a feeling of sort of a kind of level of safety, this knowing. Before we have a break, I just want to look at the awakening factors then. Because these two groups go together. And I think, well, as I've already said, with regard to working with our minds, meditation practice, they are very relevant, the most relevant ones in the fourth Satipatthana. So the seven awakening factors are also called the seven treasures of the Tathagata. This is what really makes you rich. This is the wealth that we're looking for. Next page. So there's mindfulness. Yeah. Mindfulness is the foundation, and it is always needed. Yeah. First of the awakening factors. And then we have investigation of dhammas. Mm-hmm. So we've been working with this. In the shape of interest, inquisitiveness, being curious, moving in close, investigation. We've talked about this quite a lot in regard to the refrain and what we've been doing in meditation. And it's the basic question, let me see, what's this like? Yeah. That's the attitude for practicing investigation of dhammas. Find the right piece of paper. Then that gives rise to energy. Yeah, you're engaged. When you're interested, you're engaged. You're aware of something, and that makes it alive, and out of that arises energy. Mm-hmm. And out of being engaged with something, as wholeheartedly as you can be, this is my life right now, this moment. It's not the next moment, it's not what's already happened, it's now. Yeah? Fully alive, joy arises out of that. You're happy to be engaging with what you're doing right now. It's the joy of being in the present moment. This leads on to tranquility. So it's a calming down, a deeper joy, contentment, stillness. It's not the bubbly joy, I'm doing what I really want to do, I'm engaged with it, and that is just deep contentment, kind of stillness. But it's tranquility has this flavour of joy, you could say, the colouring. But it's got also this calming down. And then out of that arises concentration, so samadhi. What's interesting here is concentration arises in dependence on tranquility, independence on joy. Concentration does not arise in dependence on force and struggle, what we often try to do with our mind in meditation. Yeah, must concentrate, get back. Yeah, that is not the path to concentration. It's the same on the spiral path, yeah, the 12, the Nidana chain there.
What's the path you have for concentration?
Pasadi. Mm-hmm. And then, out of this concentration, free of struggle now. Concentration, you could say, is a kind of free of struggle. Mm-hmm. Out of that arises equanimity or equipoise. Mm-hmm. I heard recently someone talking about the seventh awakening factor, choosing to refer to equipoise because there is still the joy. Yeah, present, something to reflect on. Mm-hmm. And what I'd like to draw our attention to is here, what Maitri Siddhi brought in last night with Tara. She talked about equipoise. Yeah, and this is, think of Tara here. Yeah? Not thinking of a stage that's really, oh, I'm never going to get there, and that's so far away. Yeah, think of Tara. This coming from this deep stillness, which is joyous, which is rooted in being present, and then stepping out, opening the hand, engaging. So it is this balance of wisdom and compassion here. Mm-hmm. You can sit with joy, and still your heart quivers with the pain of suffering, and both can be held in awareness.